welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Lance Armstrong Foundation, Dr. Larry Einhorn. As part of the 2012 Carol Treadwell Visiting Fellow Lectureship, Dr. Einhorn talked about the past, present, and future of cancer treatment at the Providence Cancer Center in Anchorage on August 1st.
Thanks, everybody, for coming here today. I'm John Hall. I'm one of the emergency physicians here at Providence. And because I once rode a bike for a little ways and helped raise some money for the Lance Armstrong Foundation, I get the honor and the pleasure of introducing to you Dr. Einhorn today. Dr. Einhorn is the 2012 Carol Treadwell Visiting Fellow. And as you know, actually, one of the architects of having this cancer center is here today, and you people have all been involved in making this cancer center possible for the state of Alaska. And we're lucky here in this state to have a lot of people that support the idea of being able to treat people in Alaska. And one of those is our Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, who along with the foundation established the Carol Treadwell Visiting Fellowship. His wife Carol died in her early 40s from brain cancer, and so he along with the foundation established this fellowship. And we're lucky enough today to have a renowned physician in Dr. Einhorn to come up here to talk to us. You have, I think, a copy of Dr. Einhorn's CV, but not everything he's done. Dr. Einhorn is a distinguished professor of medicine with the Lance Armstrong Foundation and with the University of Indiana. He pioneered the development of life-saving medical treatment in 1974 for testicular cancer, changing the survival rate from 10% to 95%. He became the first Lance Armstrong Foundation Professor of Oncology in 2006. And I could actually take several pages and read all of his accolades and accomplishments, but that would pretty much take up his whole talk and he wouldn't have any time. So I don't want to read any of that, but I do happen to want to read one little thing that I saw on the internet. And I was reading about testicular cancer, and this was a certain guy's blog who had testicular cancer. And he says on his blog, "I stumbled upon a web page that listed the email address of Lance Armstrong's doctor, Dr. Einhorn. I sent him a lengthy email regarding my treatment and condition and asked for sources of information so that I could learn more about whether I should request a change in my treatment. I ended my letter by stating that I assumed that Dr. Einhorn would never actually read my letter, but I'd appreciate a reply from his assistant or mail reader. Much to my surprise, Dr. Einhorn actually answered my letter and invited me to call him. I was shocked. I called and talked for several minutes about my case as well as Lance's. I think Dr. Einhorn's accolades and his awards will tell you what he's done in the field of oncology and medicine, but I think this response to a patient out of the blue will tell us the type of man or doctor that he is, and so it's my pleasure to be able to introduce him to you, Dr. Einhorn."
Thank you, John. Thank you, John, for that very nice introduction. And I think when John says that he did a little bicycle riding, sort of like Lance Armstrong doing a little bicycle riding, he rode across the United States and certainly very instrumental in raising money. And I think that the volunteerism that patients and physicians and caretakers have is really amazing. So the name Lance Armstrong, of course, is familiar to everyone. And I think in the annals of sports, there's no person who's made a more remarkable comeback as an athlete than Lance Armstrong. And it's one thing if you retire from a sport at the peak of your career and try to come back because you get bored or you really have the fire in the belly to compete again. But to have far advanced metastatic cancer as a reason for why you left your sport, and then to come back and not only participate in what arguably is the most arduous sport in the world, namely the Tour de France. And those who aren't familiar with that, it's about 2,400 miles riding up and down the Alps and Pyrenees, as well as the various stages of the sport. And it requires an incredible amount of mental and physical endurance and concentration to be able to do that. And not just participate in the event, but win it and dominate it for seven consecutive years is really an awe-inspiring story. And his book that he wrote with Sally Jennings, who is a sports writer for the Sports Illustrated magazine, called It's Not About the Bike, I think serves as an inspirational book, not just for testicular cancer patients, not just for cancer patients, but for all of us, because we all face various obstacles and problems in our life, and it really is just a very well-written and inspirational book. And so the title of this lecture, appropriately, is Lance Armstrong and the Tour de Cancer. So this is what Lance looked like in October of 1996 when he was diagnosed with metastatic cancer. At that time, he was 25 years old, perfectly healthy, world-class athlete, never been sick a day in his life. And he noticed for about 5 months in a row an increasing mass and pain in his right testis. Now, Lance, like many 25-year-olds in 1996, had never heard of testicular cancer, never knew there was such a thing. And he logically assumed that his testicular symptoms were due to his occupation of being on the bike all day long. And what brought him to medical attention was not pain or a mass in his right testis, but increasing back pain, shortness of breath, coughing up blood, and headaches. And when he was first diagnosed with testicular cancer, he had about 100 pulmonary metastases, multiple brain metastases, large retroperitoneal masses causing his back pain, as well as a mass in his testis. And we use a tumor marker in testis cancer called HCG, human chorionic gonadotropin, and his HCG was sky high, over 100,000 at the time he was diagnosed. Now, I think to me, there are many remarkable things about Lance's athletic career and his professional caregiving to the cancer community, but one of the least well-known is that 1 week before he was diagnosed, he competed in a race and finished second with that bulk of tumor, which is really amazing. And I guess athletes are a little bit different, you know, sort of like the rich, they're different than the rest of us. I think these star athletes are different from the rest of us also as to what they're able to endure and still compete at a very high level. And so we go from this picture of literally utter despair, as you can imagine, anyone facing this type of disease, not knowing whether he's going to live or die, not knowing whether he's ever going to be able to compete again as an athlete, to just a few years later when he won his first of seven consecutive Tour de France. And here he is crossing the Champs-Élysées and going through the Arc de Triomphe, as shown on the picture here. And you can't really see it in this picture, but everyone is cheering him, including all the French that are lining the Champs-Élysées, carrying the American flag. Perhaps it's a little different year than it would be right now. You know, I think one of my favorite lines about the French that I like shortly after 9/11 is a French commander asking the French troops to present arms, and they go like this, you know. Nevertheless, it's kind of an interesting story with Lance's relationship, especially with the French press, as well as some of the French people themselves. But this is, again, just going from this utter despair to total triumph. So before talking about where we are in the present and where I see us heading in the future, I want to just go over a little history of cancer treatment. And certainly when we're dealing with cancer treatment, for the most part, we're talking about surgery, radiation therapy for localized or local regional disease, or systemic therapy, which in the past has routinely been chemotherapy, for patients that have disseminated metastatic disease, such as Lance Armstrong presented when he was first diagnosed in 1996. And this is a quote from the well-known book from Dr. Mukherjee, The Emperor of All Maladies, which I recommend highly. He wrote this book when he was a mere fellow at Dana-Farber, and he is a very talented PhD, but even more so, I think, a very talented writer. And this is how the title of the book got its title, and I quote here, as you can read yourself, "In the end, cancer truly emerges as a 19th century surgeon once wrote in a book's front piece, as the emperor of all maladies, the king of terrors. And I think all of us face various illnesses as we endure our lifespan, but there is probably none that have the fear imbued in it, as does having a diagnosis of cancer, compared to cardiovascular disease, diabetes, stroke, or many other type of medical maladies that befall all of us as we age. Well, this is perhaps the preeminent surgeon in the late 1800s, in the 19th century, William Halsted, who was at Johns Hopkins when Johns Hopkins was just a brand new institution. And he felt for a disease like breast cancer, if you would just do a bigger surgery, you would get bigger and better results. And it's interesting how dogma becomes fact and information in the absence of data. And so the idea of doing a radical mastectomy persisted for well over 50 years after his teachings. Today, of course, we realize the concept of doing a radical mastectomy as opposed to just a lumpectomy followed by radiation therapy, with or without systemic therapy, is the way to treat many types of cancers. And doing these radical surgeries just belies logic as to what we know about cancer. Cancer does not start as a single cell and just grow in that one area. It starts as a single cell, and as we'll talk about later during this lecture as to what makes a cancer cell different from a normal cell, it does have the capabilities of replicating and metastasizing and spreading to other areas of the body. And what impacts a patient's survival with a diagnosis of cancer is not how aggressive the surgeon is, but the basic biology of the disease and having a logical approach, which is often a multi-pronged approach that includes radiation, surgery, and chemotherapy for patients with various types of cancer. Imaging is very important. And we sort of marvel in the 21st century with CT scans, MRIs, PET scans, and other sophisticated imaging techniques. But this is one of the first imaging studies from well over 100 years ago from Dr. Wilhelm Röntgen. And this is actually a picture that he took of his wife with the wedding ring being shown on the finger here. And this is the first time that someone had actually looked inside rather than outside in trying to do an examination on what goes on with a patient. And if you just think about how things used to be 150 years ago, you would listen to a patient's symptoms and you would feel with physical examination, and that would be about the level of your understanding of what's going on in the basic patient as to trying to make a diagnosis. It's kind of like, unfortunately, it happens in some developing countries. At Indiana University, we have a satellite facility in Kenya, in sub-Saharan Africa, and we often make the point that the ICU, the critical care, is really just using your hands and using a stethoscope. They don't have CT equipment and other things, and this is sort of the way it used to be worldwide. Now, unfortunately, less well known is if you continue to do radiation exposure with these x-rays, it can cause its own problems, as we certainly well know today, without adequate protection. This is one of the remarkable families in medical history. This is the Curies. This is Marie and Pierre Curie with their then young child, with their young daughter, Irene. And between the two of them, they won two separate Nobel Prizes for her work primarily on radium, which led to the development of radium as a therapy for malignancy, and that was the forefront of radiation therapy. And if you think that genes are not important, their daughter Irene later went on to get her own Nobel Prize as well. So if you fail to get a Nobel Prize as a physician, blame your parents, you know, for Pete's sakes. It's sort of like, how do you become a star athlete? You know, you have parents who are star athletes. So this is really a remarkable family. Now, one of the interesting things with radium, and I even remember this back in my childhood, they used to have these watches where they would have people with radium and a little brush just painting these luminescent things with the numbers of 1 through 12 on the watch, so it would glow in the dark. And when their brush would run dry, they would lick it with their tongue, with the radium on the tongue. And that's how we started seeing all these cases of head and neck cancer and realizing about the exposure of radiation therapy causing some diseases itself. But this is truly one of the first families of modern medical research with the Curies. This is Dr. Henry Kaplan. Dr. Henry Kaplan is credited with probably being the preeminent radiation therapy physician in the United States in the treatment of Hodgkin's disease. Hodgkin's disease, primarily in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, was a uniformly fatal disease, and he was able to do elegant studies in looking at the staging of Hodgkin's disease and the use of not palliative radiotherapy, but curative radiotherapy for the treatment of Hodgkin's disease. He was also less well known, but well involved in some of the early discoveries of monoclonal antibodies that led to some of the modern drugs such as rituximab with some of the early work that he did so many, many years ago. This is a strange picture to look at for cancer treatment history. This is World War I. Putting on gas masks were Allied soldiers because it was known that the Germans, especially in Flanders, France, were using mustard gas as chemical warfare despite the Geneva Convention, in violation of the Geneva Convention. And so many of the Allied soldiers died from exposure to mustard gas. And when pathologists did autopsies on these soldiers who died from inhaling this gas, they found an almost total dissolving of their bone marrow cells as well as their lymph nodes. And several physicians shortly after World War I thought that this was a terrible tragedy of World War I, but perhaps it could have some therapeutic advantage for patients that had leukemia, which is, of course, cancer of the bone marrow, or malignant lymphomas. And so research went on in the 20s and 1930s trying to look into certain chemical agents, such as mustard gas. But in order to use something, you have to show that it's effective, and you also have to show that it is safe. And this was, again, in very primitive times compared to what we have 90 years later. But the field really moved very slowly. And about the time that the first chemical compound to be used for cancer treatment called nitrogen mustard, which is a derivative of mustard gas that killed so many soldiers during World War I was done, World War II breaks out. And all of a sudden, the government doesn't want any knowledge that we are even looking at mustard gas as a therapeutic agent. And so nitrogen mustard in these early writings was not referred to as nitrogen mustard. It was referred to as compound X. Now, when you're the first person in the world to get a new modality of treatment, namely chemotherapy for far advanced cancer, no one knows how the drug should be given, how often it should be given, and what dosage it should be given. Again, we're not perfect in that in 2012, but far more sophisticated than we were in the 1940s. Well, you might question, what does Babe Ruth have to do with the history of cancer? This body over here was not built by steroids. This was built by beer and hot dogs primarily. And Babe Ruth in 1927, set at that time the record for most home runs in a season, hitting 60 home runs. He was referred to as the Sultan of SWAT, the Great Bambino. He also chewed tobacco quite a bit. And as often happened, when people chew tobacco, they get head and neck cancer. And so in the early 1940s, he may well have been the very first person in the world to be treated with chemotherapy, receiving nitrogen mustard for his head and neck cancer, and he had these big, huge, swollen lymph nodes in his neck bilaterally. And he got one dose of nitrogen mustard. It causes horrendous nausea and vomiting, but these lymph nodes melted away. But of course, a couple months later, they came right back again. Again, no one knew how often to give the drug, in what dosage, in what schedule, but at least it showed that a chemotherapy drug injected into the veins as opposed to surgery or radiotherapy, which is just treating one part of the body, had the capabilities of being systemic rather than localized treatment. Babe Ruth also had one of my favorite lines. In 1928, after hitting his 60 home runs, he then signed an unprecedented contract with the New York Yankees for $100,000 a year. Those of you who are baseball fans know that that's one day's salary for most of the superstars in baseball today, but this was 1928. And a sports writer asked him, how can you rationalize getting more money than the president of the United States, Calvin Coolidge? And he quipped, well, I had a better year than he did. And he probably did back then. Okay, well, let us move forward a little bit. And there are a lot of different chemotherapy drugs that have been developed since nitrogen mustard. And in the last 10 years, we're sort of going away from chemotherapy with what we call molecular targeted agents, which are non-chemotherapy drugs. But nevertheless, cisplatin or platinum remains one of the remarkable stories in the annals of medical oncology. And this is just a chemical structure of platinum. And platinum is a heavy metal like gold or silver or other heavy metals. And the history of platinum is very interesting. In the late 1960s, for a reason that perhaps defy logic, a variety of physical agents were being looked at, such as hyperthermia, electrolysis, to try to introduce radiation or chemotherapy to better penetrate through the cell membrane, get into the tumor cell, and be more effective. And one of the ways of doing cancer research was to study DNA, and one of the ways of studying DNA was to look at E. coli, which is a simple biological structure for assessing the effects of various types of treatment. So Barnett Rosenberg, when he was a biophysicist at Michigan State University, set up a water bath solution, which is like a small little aquarium, dumps a bunch of E. coli in the water bath solution, and runs this electric current. And then to see what the effect of the electric current is on E. coli, which is like looking at the effect of the electric current on DNA itself. And not only were the E. coli completely destroyed by this one little volt of electric current, but they had these single-strand filamentous changes in the structure under the microscope of the E. coli itself. And he felt that this could not possibly be just from the electric current per se. And this is where scientific genius comes about. He said, maybe there's something in the electrodes rather than what's released from the electrodes with the electric current that caused this interesting biological effect. And you guessed that the electrodes were platinum. They were specifically using the chemical term cisdiamine dichloroplatinum. So every year, there are about 1,000 ideas for how to cure cancer, quote unquote. And of course, 999 out of 1,000 are sort of thrown aside. So if you think something is going to work, you have a long and tedious process. You first have to synthesize, in this case, the salt of cisdiamine dichloroplatinum and make it into a manageable form that can actually be utilized. You then look at animal studies to see if it's killing tumor cells. And it's easy to tell that in an animal. You take a laboratory mouse, you inject tumor cells into the undersurface or the ventral surface of a mouse. It takes about 2 weeks to see visible tumor nodules. You then inject your brand new cure for cancer and see if these masses in the abdomen of the mouse will go away. But then you also have to try to determine in larger animal species what are the side effects of the chemotherapy drug and can the drug be safely managed? What is a proper dose, distribution, metabolism, et cetera, et cetera. So from the time of an idea of a drug that can be actually used to the time that is actually first used in humans and approved by the FDA often takes at least a decade. And even today, there's sort of a long trail from thought process to discovery to implementation, to actual FDA approval. So platinum was first used as a cancer drug in 1972 in what we call phase one trials. Phase one trials means that ethically, we have no standard therapy that is known to prolong survival. And so it's logical to use an innovative first-in-human trial to see if it's going to do anything. So by definition, patients who are subject, including today, to a phase one trial are patients that have very far advanced disease who are refractory to multiple lines of prior therapy. Now, when platinum was first used, this drug, like nitrogen mustard, caused severe nausea and vomiting. And that was sort of expected. That was not unexpected. That's not uncommon with cancer drugs. Cancer drugs in the 1970s were known to cause hair loss, nausea and vomiting, fatigue, low blood counts, potential for infections, et cetera, et cetera. What was not appreciated from animal trials is that platinum was also capable of causing acute renal failure. It was also capable of causing severe neurological damage with weakness and painful numbness and tingling in the hands and the feet for those patients that got more than one or two or three dosages of platinum. And so if you take about 24 patients and you treat them with a drug, and these are very far advanced patients, you're seeing the toxicity immediately, but you're not seeing much in the way of therapeutic effect. And I was a fellow at MD Anderson when platinum was first entering first-in-human trials. The drug was dangerously close to being discarded as an interesting drug, but too toxic for prime-time use. And what saved platinum from extinction was testicular cancer, just as platinum has saved so many lives of patients with testicular cancer. And by that I mean that in the phase one trials with melanoma, kidney cancer, lung cancer, renal cell carcinoma, there was a smattering of patients that had metastatic testicular cancer that failed to respond to other therapies. And these tumors were just melting away. And if a drug works as a science, we then figure out how to mitigate and ameliorate the side effects. And so indeed, the germ cell tumor marriage with platinum was a uniquely symbiotic relationship beneficial to both ends. And in 2012, there are no drugs, and that includes molecular target agents, chemotherapy, or any other drug that has such a wide panoply of activity as platinum does. And these are diseases where platinum is used as first-line therapy. Of course, only testicular cancer has the incredible success rate that we see, but ovarian cancer, small cell and non-small cell lung cancer, bladder cancer, head and neck cancer, cancer of the cervix, many of these use with radiation therapy, esophageal cancer, osteogenic sarcoma, thymomas, and with the third generation platinum, oxaliplatinum, colorectal cancer. So we have at least 11 different drugs where this is not just used, but used as the best and first-line therapy in these different diseases. Well, of course, Lance Armstrong had testicular cancer. Testicular cancer is a rare disease. It accounts for only 1% of all cancers that we see in the American male population. We see about 8,000 cases each year of testicular cancer. But it's a very important disease for many reasons. First of all, the most common malignancy in men by far is prostate cancer. And not that it's not tragic if someone dies at age 80 of prostate cancer, the average age if someone were to die from prostate cancer. If someone dies from testis cancer, this is a young man's disease. Most of our patients are diagnosed when they're in their 20s. And without hyperbole, if a patient dies prematurely from this disease, they are losing 50 years of potentially productive loss of life. Secondly, we often talk the talk about combined modality therapy, combining chemotherapy with radiotherapy, with surgery, et cetera, et cetera. And here we also walk the walk, and there are patients that are incurable with chemo alone, with surgery alone, but who are cured with chemotherapy followed by post-chemotherapy resection of residual disease. Thirdly, despite the paucity of cases, we have done random prospective phase three clinical trials answering most clinically relevant questions about how to treat patients with testicular cancer. Fourthly, it's been a wonderful harbinger for new drug discovery. Platinum would not exist if testicular cancer did not exist. Etoposide, also called VP16, and ifosfamide are two widely used chemotherapy drugs that also would not exist except for their initial activity in testicular cancer. And most importantly, the goal of therapy in this disease is never just palliation or prolongation of survival, but no matter how far advanced the disease, and Lance is a great example of this, the goal of therapy is always cure. And fortunately, we're usually able to accomplish and achieve that goal. So back in the old days, before platinum was around, this was a chemosensitive disease. We would treat patients with old-fashioned drugs such as actinomycin D, and we would see a diminution in the size and number of pulmonary metastases, including some complete remissions, which back then meant a normal chest X-ray, CTs didn't exist, serum HCG and alpha fetal protein didn't exist. And if a patient achieved a complete remission and they were not cured, most of the time they would relapse within a year, if ever. And there was a small 5 to 10% cure rate with pre-platinum drugs. We would love to have a 5 to 10% cure rate, by the way, in many forms of metastatic cancer, such as non-small cell lung cancer, the other disease that I deal with.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Larry Einhorn, Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Lance Armstrong Foundation. He was recorded speaking on the past, present, and future of cancer treatment at the Providence Cancer Center in Anchorage on August 1st.
Other agents were available in the 1970s, which were competitive with but not superior to actinomycin D, namely vinblastine and bleomycin, which were found to be not just additive, but super additive or synergistic when combined together, producing a higher cure rate than one would have expected from the single agent activity of the individual drugs. But what really revolutionized the therapy of this disease, again, was the discovery of the first heavy metal ever to be used as an anti-neoplastic agent, namely cisplatin. So among the myriad of phase one patients who were treated with single agent cisplatin were 11 patients who failed to be cured with vinblastine, bleomycin, and actinomycin D, and went on a clinical trial with an experimental drug, cisplatin. And as clinical investigators, we get very excited if we see a modicum of success and some shrinkage of a tumor with an experimental drug. Well, with cisplatin, not only did we see partial reduction of metastatic disease, but we saw 3 out of these 11 patients who achieved complete remissions. Now, this was third line or fourth line therapy done as a single agent, and all 11 of these patients subsequently died from their disease, but it demonstrated drug activity. And as I said before, despite all the side effects of cisplatin, if a drug works, you figure out how to mitigate the side effects from that particular agent. Now, single agent chemotherapy is unlikely to be the ultimate success because drug resistance develops very readily. And in the 1970s, as well as today in 2012, these are the principles of combination chemotherapy. We want drugs that are known to be active by themselves. We want their mechanism of killing the cancer cell to be separate, not to be given two drugs that kill cancer cells by the same mechanism. We want drugs that don't have the same side effects. The major dose-limiting side effect is low blood counts. If we're giving 3 drugs that all lower the blood counts, we're giving low dosages of 3 drugs. And we want evidence of not just 1 + 1 = 2, but 1 + 1 = 3 or 4 or 5, evidence of synergism, which is easy to prove in a mouse model, more difficult to prove in human oncology. So with that as a background, vinblastine and bleomycin were known to have a 25% cure rate and to be a synergistic two-drug combination. So in 1974, and this is not rocket science, we simply added the then promising experimental toxic drug cisplatin, given in this dose and schedule, to vinblastine and bleomycin in this dose and schedule. When we first started these studies, and it was such a long time ago, in 1974, the concept of treating cancer, if there was such a thing as a model for a curable neoplasm back then, it was childhood acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And in that model, the idea was that you give induction therapy and follow it with long duration maintenance therapy, as we did in this original study, giving a total of 2 years of chemotherapy. Now, cisplatin and bleomycin have cumulative toxicity. you cannot give these drugs for 2 years, but vinblastine was given for a total of 2 years of therapy. And even in my youthful exuberance back in the mid-1970s, I never would have dreamed that we would achieve these results with the introduction of a single experimental drug in this phase two non-randomized studies. Most of the time in medicine, when you get a promising result, you want to then do a large study, a phase three study, where half the patients get a standard treatment and half of them get an experimental treatment, which would have been vinblastine bleomycin versus platinum vinblastine bleomycin. But when we're seeing these types of cure rates, where we were expecting about a 10% cure rate in similar patient populations, there are ethical constraints, and platinum never was subjected to a phase three study to prove its value, as it wasn't obviously necessary. Now, we did a variety of studies after that first, phase three studies after that first trial. And this is one of the more important phase three studies we did, where we challenged one of the basic dogmas of the time, namely that in order to ensure adequate cell kill, that you needed to give long duration therapy. We felt that the main value was from the platinum, not the extra 20, 21 months of vinblastine. So we took patients who got 12 weeks of PVB, platinum vinblastine bleomycin, randomized them to a control arm, which was the total of 2 years of therapy with vinblastine, versus an experimental arm, stopping therapy at 12 weeks. This was unprecedented in oncology at that time for chemosensitive diseases. Yet, as we can see from this slide, from this publication in the New England Journal of Medicine over a quarter of a century ago, the cure rate was not even 1% difference. So adding that extra 21 months of maintenance vinblastine just added cost, toxicity, and inconvenience without improving therapeutic efficacy. Now, if a treatment works in Indiana, it should work in the United States, in the lower 48, in Alaska, Hawaii, or anywhere around the world. This is data from the NCI, from the SEER registry, from Eric Foyer, published back in 1991, looking at when our first trial started, when the abstract was first published, when the paper was first published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, showing this dramatic improvement on a national basis in the survival of patients with testicular cancer. And just to give you a couple of slides over here of some before after pictures, and some of these could be a Lance Armstrong type of picture. This is someone who came to us in the 1970s, had failed previous therapy with actinomycin D, came to see us for platinum velband bleomycin, critically ill, severely hypoxic, and as seen on the lateral, he has almost complete replacement of his pulmonary parenchyma with metastatic embryonal carcinoma. Now, as sick as this patient was, if this was any disease other than testis cancer, we would be talking hospice and supportive care alone. But this is testis cancer, and the goal was cure, and he's been long since cured, this x-ray from 1978. This is one of our choriocarcinoma patients with multiple large cannonball pulmonary metastases, again, long since cured of his cancer. And this is an abdominal CT from a patient with metastases, also with most of his liver replaced by metastatic testicular cancer, again, with a very dramatic improvement and long since cured of his metastatic cancer to the liver from his testicular cancer. Well, as I mentioned, the concept of synergism, of combining drug A with drug B and having a super additive effect, is easy to document in a mouse. You inject tumor cells into a mouse, wait until there are visible tumor nodules, you inject drug A and see how long the mice lives, the mouse lives, you inject drug B, see how long the mouse lives, and then you inject drug A and drug B at the same time, combination chemotherapy, and see if you have an increase in lifespan. And this was done in this study with P388 leukemia in a murine model. Cisplatin as a single agent had a minimal prolongation of survival in this mouse model. Etoposide or VP16, the mice lived a few weeks longer. But when the two drugs were given together, there was actually about a 25% cure rate in this mouse model. And this actually was replicated in human oncology as well. When a patient was not cured with platinum, vinblastine, bleomycin, PVB, If one were to give single-agent cisplatin, the cure rate would be zero. If one were to give VP16 etoposide as a single agent, the cure rate would be zero. Yet when the two drugs were given together as second-line or third-line therapy, almost a quarter of these patients were cured of their disease. And this was the first example in an adult solid tumor where a second or third line chemotherapy regimen actually could reproducibly cure patients. Now, with that as a background, our next clinical trial we did was to compare the older PVB regimen to looking at this then newer experimental drug, VP16 or etoposide. So this is a simple substitution, looking at this drug as a newer drug compared to this drug as an older drug with the same cisplatin and bleomycin on both arms. We had dropped the idea of the 21 months of maintenance therapy with vinblastine, so this was therapy every 3 weeks for four courses or 12 weeks of therapy. Now, before the first patient entered this phase 3 randomized trial, we knew that we were going to get less toxicity with etoposide, but we also had a higher cure rate with the number of patients continuously showing no evidence of disease, with a 12% improvement in the cure rate. Now, after this study was done, we then looked at a study of how many courses of platinum was necessary for those patients that didn't have the Lance Armstrong type of massive disease. So we randomized patients to a control arm of four courses of bleomycin etoposide platinum, no longer looking at PVB, versus three courses of therapy. And this is not just reduction of one course of therapy. This is elimination of the most toxic of the four courses because of cumulative potential for pulmonary fibrosis with bleomycin, potential cumulatively for leukemia from etoposide, and the cumulative anorexia, nausea, vomiting, neural toxicity, and ototoxicity from platinum. So we felt ethically, logically, and scientifically that this was a rational study to do to see if we can eliminate the fourth and most toxic course of therapy. And once again, we found no difference between the longer duration of therapy compared to the shorter duration of therapy. So this particular study ended in 1986. And so from 1974 to 1986, over 12 years, we went from PVB, four courses of platinum therapy, 2 years of chemotherapy, to 9 weeks of chemotherapy, and for the majority of the patients, having this type of cure rate with this type of therapy. Well, a newer drug came about in the 1980s, ifosfamide. And ifosfamide is a fairly toxic drug, and we wanted to see in our very far advanced patients, like Lance Armstrong type of patients, whether ifosfamide would be better than bleomycin, which is the least effective of the three drugs in the BEP regimen. So this is a clinical trial that we designed to answer that question, and this was just used in those patients that had very advanced disease rather than the patients that just had small metastatic deposits. And this turned out, unfortunately, to be a negative study. We saw a lot more myelosuppression, nausea and vomiting, and some degree of kidney damage with the ifosfamide arm compared to the bleomycin arm, which is why this remains standard therapy. So why show this totally negative study? Well, back to the hero of the piece here, Lance Armstrong. We do a lot of talking in 2012 about personalized therapy, and by that, we want to be looking at the specific genetic mutation or abnormality that's seen in an individual patient's tumor. For example, a woman with breast cancer, we always want to know her estrogen progesterone receptor, whether she's HER2 positive or negative, but we also want to know many other aspects molecularly about the tumor so that we can develop individualized therapy rather than treating all lung, breast, colorectal cancer patients exactly the same. We did personalized therapy with Lance Armstrong, not on a molecular basis, but on a clinical basis. When he came to Indiana University, his number one concern, as you can imagine, was, am I going to survive this disease? He had a form of cancer that was so far advanced that there was about a 40 to 50% chance he would survive his disease and about a 50 to 60% chance that he would die from his disease. So his second very distant concern, would I be able to get back on the bike again and compete as a professional athlete? But goal number one far superseded goal number two. And so we told him that we knew that VIP was equivalent to BEP. It would make him sicker during the 12 weeks, especially as far as nausea and vomiting is concerned. But the B drug and bleomycin can reduce your diffusion capacity. It probably would have little or no effect upon anyone in the room over here getting bleomycin as far as what we do as a profession. But if you're doing 2,200 miles up and down the Alps and the Pyrenees and the Tour de France, a 1% reduction in your diffusion capacity is going to terminate your professional athletic career. So we gave him personalized therapy with his consent, giving him VIP instead of BEP because we had the results of our negative phase 3 280 patient trial, knowing that they were equivalent. The next issue had to do with his brain metastases. The standard dogma for treating brain metastases was that chemotherapy drugs do not get through what we call the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain like they do in the lung and the abdominal lymph nodes. And so you need to give whole brain radiotherapy when you have bilateral brain metastases. Giving whole brain radiotherapy has its many, many side effects, not the least of which is balance problems. You're never going to be riding up and down the mountains getting whole brain radiotherapy. So once again, we offered him a form of personalized therapy. We gave him one course of VIP therapy, and then just prior to his second of four courses, we had one of our neurosurgeons surgically resect a lesion on each side of the brain, not with the idea of doing that therapeutically, but doing it diagnostically. With the idea of that there was cancer there, we needed to do the radiotherapy. So these lesions were resected and was just blood. So one course was enough to get into the brain. And the rationale there was we felt that when someone has 100 pulmonary metastases and three or four small brain metastases that are asymptomatic other than some mild headaches, what's going to determine the cure rate is what's going on below the neck. And our drugs do get into the brain, they just don't get into the brain as well. And so subsequently, it's very rare that we give anyone brain radiotherapy anymore when they have brain metastases with testicular cancer. Well, what do we do in 2012 if someone is treated with standard first-line chemotherapy and they respond, and by the way, 100% of the patients respond, but they don't respond completely, or they do respond completely and they subsequently have evidence of progressive disease? We can still cure patients, even though they weren't cured the first time around, with the concept of high-dose chemotherapy. Now, this was a failed strategy, bone marrow transplant, if you will, in breast cancer, and it was almost predestined to be a failed strategy. The idea is that you can harvest someone's healthy blood cells, store them in a freezer, give five times the dosage of what you would normally give with chemotherapy, a super high dosage, and you can prevent fatalities by giving the patient back their own healthy blood cells, which then came from the bone marrow. Now we get them from the peripheral blood stem cell transplant. In breast cancer, the best drugs are doxorubicin, which is Adriamycin, and the taxanes, paclitaxel and docetaxel, arguably. You cannot give those drugs in five times the dosage because when you do bone marrow or peripheral blood stem cell transplant, you're only protecting from myelosuppressive complications from low blood counts. You cannot protect from cardiac toxicity of Adriamycin or the neurological toxicity of the taxanes, docetaxel and paclitaxel. Well, with testis cancer, an analog of cisplatin is carboplatin. Its dose-limiting toxicity is myelosuppression. The second best drug after the platinums is etoposide. Its only dose-limiting toxicity is myelosuppression. So this is a logical laboratory to look at the concept of high-dose chemotherapy, which we first started doing in 1986. And then in 1996, we gentrified the procedure from going to from bone marrow transplant to peripheral blood stem cell transplant. And these are the results. These are patients who were not cured and had progressive disease, 184 consecutive patients, and remarkably, over 6% who were not cured with metastatic cancer the first time around are cured with this type of approach. If we use it as second-line therapy as opposed to third-line therapy, the results are better. They're a little bit better with seminoma than they are with non-seminoma. And this perhaps is the most remarkable line of all on this slide. Platinum refractory means that the patient has progressed within 4 weeks of their last course of cisplatin and etoposide. And now we're giving high-dose platinum and etoposide. And logically, you would think this would do nothing or at best a brief partial remission. Almost half of the patients were cured, so we can overcome drug resistance in this disease by greatly escalating the dosages in this chemosensitive tumor. Well, when we stage test this cancer, and of course the patients that we've been talking about with chemotherapy are all stage 3 patients with metastatic disease, this is the way survival curves used to look like before platinum was around. And I would point out that a urologist doing a retroperitoneal lymph node dissection has a very remarkably high cure rate with surgery alone. In fact, higher than any surgeon has with any other type of tumor in the presence of nodal metastases. So this is not just the most chemo-curable disease, it's also the most surgically curable disease in the presence of nodal metastases. And of course, stage 3 disease in the actinomycin D or vinblastine bleomycin era, 90% of the patients succumb from their disease, most within 1 or 2 years of diagnosis. And these are the type of results that are achieved in Anchorage and Indianapolis and around the world. When we combine all stages, not just the stage 3 patients, 95% of patients will be cured of their disease. All of the patients who come in initially or eventually with metastatic disease, over 80% of them will be cured of their metastatic testicular cancer. Well, that's fine and good, but testicular cancer once again represents 1% of all the malignancies that we see in American men. These are the 5 most prevalent cancers in this country, and the same would be true in Western Europe and many other countries as well. And when we look at not just cases, and prostate cancer is much higher depending upon the prevalence of PSA screening, but when we look at deaths, and if you do some simple arithmetic, the number of people dying each year from lung cancer is greater than the number of people dying from the number 2, the number 3, the number 4, and the number 5 causes of cancer death combined. So as I said before, we now understand the biology of a cancer toolbox. What makes a cancer cell differ from a normal cell? You know, as we all age, we're more prone to get cancer. Cancer is a genetic disease. We call it a genetic disease not because we inherit it from our parents or our grandparents, but we all have 30,000 genes from the Human Genome Project. All it takes is one mutation in one gene to cause cancer, ergo we refer to it as a genetic disease. What causes these mutations? Well, we know with lung cancer, 85% of lung cancer patients are smoking related. 15% of lung cancer patients have never smoked and probably have little, if any, exposure to secondhand smoke. We don't know why people get breast cancer, prostate cancer, colorectal cancer, for that matter, testicular cancer either. Smoking is a causative agent in renal cell, bladder, head and neck cancer, and of course, lung cancer and so many other diseases. Now, as far as what makes a cell differ from a normal cell, as we get older, it's no surprise we're more prone to get these mutations and to get cancer. No one really dies of old age, and I noticed in the newspaper and the news, Mrs. Rasmussen, who sounded like a remarkable woman, died at 101, and I don't know what the cause of her death was, but people don't really die of old age. They die of cancer, heart disease, strokes, diabetes, or some type of medical problems. And the older someone is, the higher the probability of getting and dying from cancer. Now, we all have an instinct to live and to survive, but our cells have an instinct to die and to undergo old age or senescence, if you will. You know, all of our hair gets more sparse and turns gray rather than getting more plentiful and turning blacker as we get older. That's not what happens with a cancer cell. A cancer cell doesn't get older. A cancer cell doesn't stop dividing and becoming more plentiful. And these are the mechanisms, as shown on this slide over here, of what distinguishes a cancer cell from a normal cell. This was first published a decade ago by Doug Hanahan and Bob Weinberg in the journal Cell, And anyone who's really interested as a cancer scientist, this is probably the preeminent article on what differentiates a cancer cell and what we can look at as targets to exploit differences between cancer cells and normal cells and develop drugs that attack these different mechanisms. And this is what we refer to as molecular targeted agents rather than chemotherapy. And this is an example of several successful molecular targeted agents. The most successful are these drugs over here. Rituximab and lymphoma, which has just been such an incredible drug in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Herceptin or trastuzumab in breast cancer. Imatinib or Gleevec in chronic myelogenous leukemia and gastrointestinal stromal diseases. These particular tumors here with imatinib are somewhat unique cancers. They have a single molecular abnormality. This is like Jonas Salk finding out that a virus causes polio. If you find a single causative agent, you can develop something that blocks that agent, a la the vaccinations for polio. So if you have a single molecular abnormality, you can develop a drug, in this case imatinib, that blocks that abnormality, prevents a further pathogenesis and spread of the disease, and can produce very, very long remissions in these particular diseases. Well, this is sort of fantasy cancer. Real cancer is lung cancer, especially smoking-related lung cancer, where we might have simultaneously 20 different mutations. So we develop a drug that blocks a mutation, and we get a fantastic remission. And 3 months later, the cancer is right back again because there are 19 other mutations that are taking over the so-called driver mutation. But nevertheless, these are all non-chemotherapy drugs that are known to prolong survival, sometimes miraculously so, as in the FORCE-4 diseases over here, looking at non-chemotherapy agents. Where do our cancer drugs come from in 2012? They come from the pharmaceutical industry. They rarely come from laboratories and universities like Indiana University. It is unbelievably expensive to do drug development. Most industries that are involved with drug development are rarely looking at chemotherapy any longer. They're looking at finding a particular mutation in an individual patient's tumor, see if that mutation can be therapeutically exploited, develop a drug that blocks that mutation, and to do it in human trials. And these are, again, non-chemotherapy or molecular targeted agents. So in the final minute or two over here, it's hard to believe that this was 1964, 48 years ago, that the Surgeon General came out, and I quote with this warning, "Cigarette smoking is a health hazard of sufficient importance in the United States to warrant appropriate remedial action." Can you imagine how many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of lives would have been saved if we had the political will to get rid of tobacco? There are certain things we cannot help. As we age, we get mutations, we get cancer. But about a fourth of all cancer deaths, a fourth of them at least, are related to something we can do something about, which has to do with smoking. What actually changed in this country, the smoking cessation programs, is not science or a Surgeon General's warning, but litigation. And this little picture here, and this is your own molecular targeted therapy, with the target being the tobacco, and the little three-piece lawyers supporting the tobacco industry, firing their volleys to Congress to prevent more stern warnings, to prevent them from taking commercials off the air, to prevent them from Joe Camel catering to pre-adolescent children as a cartoon character for smoking. Hollywood is to blame. It used to be that you couldn't go to a G-rated movie without seeing smoking in the movie over here. But it was litigation, probably more than anything else, that has lessened smoking. If you watch Mad Men on television, everyone's smoking. We don't see that anymore. Smoking is still a major issue, but not the way it was in the 1960s, or certainly in 1964 to 1974, the first decade of the Surgeon General's warning. And I'll end this talk with something that is science fiction. Andy von Eschenbach was the director of the FDA and the director of the NCI at the same time. I knew him from my days at MD Anderson. He's a urologist. He's a cancer patient himself. And he had this very laudatory statement that you sometimes have to do when you're appearing before Congress trying to increase the cancer appropriations for cancer research. And it says, our goal is to eliminate pain and death from cancer by the year 2015, if only. And this really is science fiction. This is also science fiction. It's just about 100 years ago that H.G. Wells wrote War of the Worlds. This is a movie poster from our great Scientologists over here, Tom Cruise, appearing in the War of the Worlds. I want to end with a quote from H.G. Wells from 100 years ago. The disease of cancer will be banished from life by calm, unhurrying, persistent men and women. This was 100 years ago. Working with every shiver of feeling controlled and suppressed in hospitals and labs, and the motive that will conquer cancer will neither be pity nor horror. It will be curiosity to know how and why. Well, thank you very much for your attention. I'll be happy to field any questions.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Dr. Larry Einhorn, Distinguished Professor of Medicine at the Lance Armstrong Foundation. He was recorded speaking on the past, present, and future of cancer treatment at the Providence Cancer Center in Anchorage on August 1st as part of the 2012 Carol Treadwell Visiting Fellow Lectureship. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.